Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Ziemert, and it's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Ted Vanita, who is serving as our worship associate. We are glad to be together today and glad to welcome you to this religious community, a community that seeks to celebrate and to serve. If you are with us for the first time this morning, I would like to extend to you a special welcome. We're always delighted to have guests at our services and hope that you will stay afterward for a time of fellowship and refreshment downstairs in Fessenden Hall. And if you find that you would like more information about the life and work of this community, I encourage you to complete the guest card, which you can find in the racks in the pews in front of you. Please do explore both sides of the card, and you may place a completed card in the offering basket when it comes to you later in the service, or hand it to a representative of our membership committee who would be glad to greet you at the visitor's table after the service. The visitor's table is just outside the sanctuary doors. There you can also pour yourself a cup of tea and take a look at the collection in our church library. Ours is a church that strives to practice the fragile art of hospitality. And so in that spirit, I invite you to take a moment to turn and greet your neighbors. In addition to asking you to silence your cell phones, I would like to direct your attention to the thread from the web. That is the insert in your order of service. There you will find several important announcements as well as a calendar of events for the week ahead in the church. I would particularly like to call to your attention the upcoming Walden weekend. Where's Walden in the winter? It will be held Saturday, February 21st from 10 to 3:30 at the Hiram College Field Station. This is a wonderful time spent out in nature exploring our transcendentalist heritage with Henry David Thoreau. More information about this family-friendly activity is downstairs in Fessenden Hall along with a sign-up sheet. Next week, you are again invited to join us for worship at 9:30 and 11:15. Christina Spouty will be leading the service. Her sermon is entitled Fruit of the Spirit. At the end of today's service, Ted and I would be glad to greet you at the rear of the sanctuary. And once again, I bid you welcome.
Of a spontaneous sharing of happiness or joy can sustain us during difficult times. This morning's reading is by Leah Hunt. Jenny kissed me when we met, jumping from the chair she sat in. Time, you thief who love to get sweets into your list, put that in. Say I'm weary, say I'm sad, say that health and wealth have missed me. Say I'm growing old, but add, Jenny kissed me.
Hal, when I hear you play that beautiful new piano, I'm reminded by a little poem by Basho. The temple bell stops, but the sound keeps coming out of the flowers. That's what I think of when I hear that piano. I have a confession to make to you all, and that is, when Melissa asks for silence, and when she does her beautiful prayers, I do not bow my head, and I do not close my eyes when I'm sitting up here as worship associate. What I do is I look out over the congregation, and I see each of you sitting there, and I think, you know, how fortunate I am, and we all are, to have each other here in this wonderful place. And it just makes me feel, I must say, full of love. And I just wanted to confess that to you so that you would know, as you bow your heads and close your eyes, that I am not. But I am doing something very important. I'm looking at you all, and I'm thinking those things. And I think it was Aristotle who told us that love is universal. Love is truly a universal thing. Come, let us worship together.
Will you love? Will you feel? Will you care? Our presence here this morning is our answer. We come ready or not, but willing and hoping. Spirit of life and love, open us, touch us, transform us as we cannot transform ourselves. Give us to live the lives that are longing to live in us. Amen, and blessed be. This morning, our words of love have been arranged as a litany. All of the poems have been selected from a remarkable book, Love Poems from God, Sacred Voices from the East and West. After each poem, we invite you to sing the litany that is printed in your order of service. The choir will sing it the first time, and you are invited to join in on the next three opportunities.
You might quiet the whole world for a second if you pray, and if you love, if you really love, our guns will wilt. From the Carmelite reformer and mystical poet, St. John of the Cross.
Open my heart.
I remember how my mother would hold me. I would look up at her sometimes and see her weep. I understand now what was happening. Love is so strong a force, it broke the cage, and she disappeared from everything for a blessed moment. From the renowned poet saint of India, Mirabai.
I know all the ways of the heart, how it wants to be alive. Love so needs to love that it will endure almost anything, even abuse, just to flicker for a moment. But the sky's mouth is kind. Its song will never hurt you, for I will sing those words. What will our children do in the morning if they do not see us fly? This is from the poet, the Sufi mystic poet Rumi.
I know about love the way the fields know about light, the way the forest shelters, the way an animal's divine, raw desire seeks to unite with whatever might please its soul without a single strange thought of remorse. There is a powerful delegation in us that lobbies for contentment every moment. How will you ever find peace unless you yield to love? The way the gracious earth does to our hand's impulse. From one of the most beloved female Islamic saints, Rabia of Basra.
And this last from the beloved Christian mystic and priest, Meister Eckhart. All day long a little burrow labors, sometimes with heavy loads on her back and sometimes just with worries about things that bother only burrows. And worries, as we know, can be more exhausting than physical labor. Once in a while, a kind monk comes to her stable and brings a pear. But more than that, he looks into the burro's eyes and touches her ears. And for a few seconds, the burro is free and even seems to laugh, because love does that. Love frees.
This week, many celebrations will be held in commemoration of the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. Since Darwin's evolutionary thought has been so influential in the development of Unitarian Universalist theology, it seems only right to consider this morning's celebration of love with a bit of perspective won by science. With Drs. Lewis, Amini, and Lennon, the authors of the book whose title inspired this sermon, we will begin with the brain. Now, if it's been a while since you looked at a diagram of the brain, I'll remind you that scientists have been able to identify three related yet distinct parts of the mammalian brain. These are technically called the hindbrain, the midbrain, and the forebrain. Very basically, the hindbrain and midbrain, most evocatively referred to as the reptilian brain, is the oldest part of the brain and the one we share with reptiles and amphibians. This part of the brain operates involuntarily and regulates vital functions like breathing, swallowing, and heartbeat. It also contains a startle center, which alerts us to sudden unexpected stimuli, like when a sudden loud noise makes us jump. The forebrain is a later evolutionary development and one we share with all mammals. The oldest part of the forebrain was termed the limbic brain by a 19th century neurologist, and it represents our emotional control center, our principal emotional control center. It's responsible for our feelings and for our drive to nurture, communicate, connect, and play. While the limbic brain exerts the greatest influence over our social and emotional lives, it does have many connections to the newest part of the cortex, aptly termed the neocortex. The neocortex imposes logic and reasoning into our emotional lives and is also responsible for our ability to think abstractly. This is the part of the brain which enables us to speak, write, plan, organize, and create. Scientists have observed that while there are connections between the three parts of the brain, each part maintains primary control over its own domain. For example, what we describe as conscious will lies within the domain of the neocortex. Because emotions are primarily controlled by the limbic brain, we cannot will ourselves to feel a certain way. As our authors explain, emotional life can be influenced, but it cannot be commanded. Since Charles Darwin was convinced that emotions served some biological usefulness, he devoted a significant portion of his study to emotional expression. For years, he cataloged facial expressions and formulated hypotheses about how each expression enhanced human life. These ideas were not well received in his time and fell into obscurity for many years. However, 30 years ago, two scientists working independently took up where Darwin left off and concluded that facial expressions are indeed everywhere identical. All around the globe, people express sadness, happiness, anger, and disgust in exactly the same way on their faces. This is true even among people who are blind. From this knowledge, scientists have concluded that the facial expression of emotion is innate. What's more, it's not only innate for us, but also for our closest relatives. The great apes have facial expressions that resemble our own. As our authors explain, this shared biological expression of emotion means that we can gain complex knowledge about the internal state of another person even without language. Likewise, attentive people can gain complex knowledge about our own emotional states even when we do not speak of how we feel. This is important because it is the foundation of understanding what scientists call limbic resonance, the capacity that enables two mammals to become attuned to each other's inner states. Limbic resonance is what makes it possible for a parent to love their infant child. Limbic resonance is what makes it possible for us to attach so deeply to our dogs and cats and other pets. Limbic resonance is what makes us respond to a smile with a smile. Limbic resonance is what enables us to feel empathy for the experience of another. Without this capacity, we would be unable to connect to each other. Thus, limbic resonance is the foundation of our capacity to love. Scientific research has thus given us proof for what we already know, that the capacity for love is not only desirable and pleasant, but necessary for us to live a typical human life. Consider the unintentional experiment conducted on infants in orphanages in the 1940s. The authorities, concerned about protecting infants from diseases the adults might be harboring, ordered that the babies were to be fed and clothed and kept warm and clean, but that they were not to be played with or held in order to keep their exposure to germs and infections to a minimum. These babies typically became withdrawn, underweight, and much more susceptible to disease than infants who were handled and played with. The babies who fared the worst were the ones who were in the cleanest and most well-regarded institutions. Death rates for those babies were routinely above 75%. More recently, researchers have replicated such conditions with rhesus monkeys. It turns out that while monkeys typically survive social isolation, the lives they live are so troubled that they do not at all resemble typical monkeys. Monkeys raised in social isolation are rendered incapable of engaging in typical social interaction with other monkeys. They don't know how to play. They don't know how to mate. They don't know how to eat or drink normally. Their behavior is unpredictable. They are at times violent towards others and also toward themselves. They bite their own arms and bang their heads against the walls. Studies such as these had led scientists to conclude that affection, nurture, and care are biological necessities. For the human young, attachment to a loving adult is a matter of life and death. Older people are capable of physically surviving the lack of caring social relationships, but they are inevitably wounded by isolation. As our authors explain, our basic physiological functions are actually regulated by being in loving relationships. They call this limbic regulation. It thus seems fair to conclude that we are not equipped to completely self-regulate. We require the presence of another for most of our vital physiological functions, like heart rate, blood pressure, body temperature, and more. And so interdependence isn't really an idea at all. It's a biological fact. We need one another to love. We need one another to live. So if limbic resonance is the capacity that makes love possible and limbic regulation is the exchange that reveals love to be necessary, limbic revision is the process that enables love to shape identity. This part of the science strikes me as especially complicated, but from what I understand, the process of being in loving relationship with another person literally remodels our brains. Due to the complicated and involuntary physiological communication that happens between two attached people, it may well be that pathways are created in the brain which get reinforced as we continue to be in relationship with someone. Thus, in a very literal sense, who we are and who we become depends in part on whom we love. As I understand it, this is part of the reason it can be so difficult to find a new balance after we lose someone we love to broken relationship or to death. Now, I am not, nor have I ever been, a scientist. Ted, who is a scientist, a neuroscientist, helped me a great deal this week to understand the neurobiology I've just shared with you. And my job as a preacher is not really at its core about teaching. It's about reminding you of the important things that you already know. So if you learn something new, as I certainly did from this quick little tour through the scientific basis for love, that's great. But the reason I decided to share in such detail what science can teach us about love is because it illuminates what our tradition has been teaching about love for centuries. Love is the greatest gift of life. We need love to live. Love makes us who we are. Love heals. Love saves. And if there is any force or power or spirit worthy of the name of God, it is most certainly the force and power and spirit of love. This is the claim that our universalist forebears held at the center of their religious identity. The core of their message was essentially that God is love, and that God would therefore ultimately grant salvation to all souls. That's why many of our churches are called All Souls, even those who had profoundly wandered astray. One of the most influential preachers of Universalism was a man named Hosea Ballou. Ballou was born in the latter part of the 18th century to a humble family. His mother died when he was only 2 years old, and he was raised by his father, a farmer, who was also a Calvinist Baptist preacher. He taught his son what he knew, but the education that he had to pass on was quite meager. Ballou practiced reading by studying the Bible. And through his study, he became convinced that the biblical basis for universal salvation was in the Bible, and he felt called to teach and preach the word as he understood it. He became an itinerant universalist preacher across northern New England and eventually the leading advocate of universalism in his generation. Ballou's great work summarizing his thought is called A Treatise on Atonement. Through close reading of biblical texts, reasoned reflection upon those texts, impassioned testimony, and the use of story and parable, Ballou paints a portrait of God as just, powerful, wise, and loving, and argues that such a sublime being could not fail to provide for the final holiness and happiness of all. Those are his words, the final holiness and happiness of all. In his writing, Ballou frequently imagines God as a parent and argues that God could be no less kind and loving than the most kind and loving earthly parent. Ballou offers this parable for persuasion. Imagine that a father has 10 children, but only enough food to feed 5 of them. Would the father sit down and reasonably choose to let his children slowly starve to death by asking all 10 of them to share the insufficient food? Or would the father reasonably choose 5 of his children to live while condemning the other 5 to death? Ballou argues that just as no earthly father could be imagined to reasonably choose condemnation for some of his children, but would sooner give his own life that they might all survive, surely neither could a heavenly father reasonably be imagined to make such a choice. Hear these words from Ballou. There is nothing in heaven above nor in earth beneath that can do away sin but love. And we have reason to be eternally thankful that love is stronger than death, that many waters cannot quench it, nor the floods drown it, that it hath power to remove moral maladies of mankind and to make us free from the laws of sin and death, to reconcile us to God. O love, thou great physician of souls, what a work thou hast undertaken. All souls are thy patients. Prosperous be thy labors. In Ballou's time, this understanding of God as eternal and all-conquering love was the belief that underscored the Universalists' impassioned defense of universal salvation. They worked hard to share the message, and the good news is that in many ways they succeeded. However, in the twilight years of Universalism as an independent denomination, the promise of universal salvation had lost its power because of their success. Faith in universal salvation had become mainstream. The Universalists in the years just before merger with the Unitarians were struggling to articulate a new Universalist theology for a new age. The emerging new Universalist theology was deeply influenced by the social gospel movement, a movement among Christians to make manifest in word and deed Jesus' teaching to love our neighbors as ourselves. And so the Universalists said that love requires something of us. It makes demands. One of my theological school professors, the Reverend David Bumba, argues that while the Universalists began this important work of theological redefinition, it was never fully realized. What, he asks, does it mean to proclaim that God is love and that love is redemptive in a world that has known as much evil, hatred, and violence as ours? Bumba suggests that the process of merging two denominations distracted us from these very important but not fully answered questions about theological identity. What does it mean to be a Unitarian Universalist? What do we believe? Some people try to say that to be a Unitarian Universalist is to be free to believe whatever you want, but I don't think that that's true. I would argue that to be a Unitarian Universalist is to believe in the redemptive power of love, along with the urgent call to justice. For justice is the work of making real the changes in the world that we would have for those we love. Justice is only possible because of love. This tradition, as I understand it, asks us to make a faithful practice of love as we commit ourselves to the lifelong work of making justice real. These are not small demands, nor are they abstractions. The journey to justice is a journey of generations. Each generation is obliged to envision another piece of what it means to create beloved community in our own time. And the practice of love is the practice of a lifetime. Each day, another chance to make it real in word and in deed. Nature has given us the capacity to love. Grace has given us the opportunity to love. Life depends on our ability to love. Love makes us who we are. Love heals, love saves, and love is the power or force or spirit that will sustain us as we give ourselves again and again to the work that justice demands. Love and justice, justice and love, each of these constitute the core of our faith. The gifts of each constitute a vision worthy of devotion. This is the tradition that we have been given. May we serve it well. Amen, and blessed be. I send you with these old words from one of the first Universalist preachers in this country, John Murray. Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God. Go in peace.